A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking two things. First, the raw number. How many Jewish immigrants have actually moved to Israel since the state was founded in 1948? And second, the more interesting question. How do Jewish immigrants from different places differ in how they approach integration and adaptation? Because, as anyone who's spent 5 minutes here knows, a Russian-speaking engineer from Moscow, and an Ethiopian farmer, and a French dentist, and an American retiree are not all doing Aliyah the same way. So where do we even start with this?
The number first, because it's actually staggering when you sit with it. Since 1948, roughly 3.4 million Jewish immigrants have moved to Israel. That's the cumulative total the Jewish Agency and the Central Bureau of Statistics track. For context, the entire Jewish population of Israel at founding was about 650,000. So the country has absorbed more than 5 times its founding Jewish population through immigration alone.
3.4 million? And that's net of people who left?
No, that's gross immigration, total arrivals. Net is lower because people do leave, but the gross number is what the prompt is asking about, and the distribution across time is wildly uneven. The biggest single wave was the first 4 years after independence, 1948 through 1951, when nearly 690,000 arrived, which actually doubled the Jewish population. You had Holocaust survivors, you had entire Jewish communities from Iraq and Yemen airlifted out, you had Jews from North Africa. It was chaos, logistically and economically. People lived in tents for years.
The Ma'abaro.
The transit camps. Then you get another massive wave in the 90s after the Soviet Union collapsed. Roughly 1 million Russian-speaking Jews arrived between 1990 and 2000. That's the single largest wave from one geographic origin. And then smaller but significant waves from Ethiopia, operations. Moses in 1984 and Solomon in 1991 brought about 90,000 Ethiopian Jews total.
The 3.4 million isn't a steady trickle. It's these enormous pulses, and then quieter decades in between.
The 60s and 70s were relatively modest, maybe 20 to 30,000 a year. The 80s picked up a bit. Then the Soviet wave hit, and it was just, the country's population grew by nearly 20% in a decade. Imagine any country absorbing immigrants equivalent to a fifth of its population in 10 years.
There's a phrase for that, and it's demographic panic followed by grudging absorption.
That's not inaccurate. But here's the thing about the second part of the prompt, the integration differences. Because the 3.4 million number flattens everything, it makes it sound like one coherent story, and it's not. It's a dozen different stories that barely resemble each other.
Break it down. Who integrates how?
Let's start with the Russian-speaking Aliyah, because it's the largest and most studied. The million or so immigrants from the former Soviet Union arrived with extremely high human capital. I'm talking engineers, doctors, musicians, mathematicians. Something like 60% had academic degrees, which was way above the Israeli average at the time. But here's the paradox. They also had the hardest time getting professional recognition. A Russian-trained physician couldn't just start practicing in Israel. They had to redo licensing exams, often in Hebrew, which they didn't speak yet. So you had this surreal situation in the early 90s where your taxi driver might have been a neurosurgeon in Minsk.
The classic immigrant compression.
And the response was fascinating. Rather than fully assimilate into Israeli culture, the Russian-speaking community largely built parallel institutions. Russian-language newspapers, Russian-language theater, Russian bookstores, eventually Russian language television channels. They created what sociologists call an ethnic enclave, but a highly educated one. Political parties too. Yisrael Beitenu emerged directly from this community, so integration was partial. Economic integration happened reasonably well over time. By the 2000s, the wage gap between Russian-speaking immigrants and native Israelis had narrowed significantly. But cultural integration. Many still consume mostly Russian language media, socialize mostly within the community. It's what researchers call segmented assimilation.
Segmented assimilation, meaning you pick and choose which parts of the host society you join and which you don't.
And it works. Second-generation Russian-speaking Israelis are fully bilingual. They serve in the military, they're integrated into the workforce, but they maintain a distinct cultural identity. It's not a failure of integration, it's a specific mode of it. That's a completely different story, and honestly a harder one. The Ethiopian Aliyah came predominantly from rural agrarian communities with low formal education levels. Many arrived without literacy in any language, let alone Hebrew. The cultural gap was enormous. We're talking about moving from villages without electricity to a modern technological economy essentially overnight. And I think it's fair to say the state was not well prepared for this. Absorption centers were designed around a certain model of immigrant: literate, familiar with bureaucracy, able to navigate the system, and the Ethiopian community needed a fundamentally different approach that they didn't always get.
There was also the religious legitimacy fight, which I think people outside Israel don't always understand. The chief rabbinate questioned whether Ethiopian Jews were halakhically Jewish, which meant some had to undergo symbolic conversion to be married in Israel. That's its own layer of alienation.
Yes, and that created lasting distrust. Integration has been slow. There are still significant gaps in educational attainment, employment rates, and income. But it's also not a static picture. The second generation, Israelis born to Ethiopian parents, are doing considerably better than their parents. University enrollment is rising, representation in media and politics is growing, though still low. The military has been a major integration vehicle, as it is for most immigrant communities here, but probably disproportionately important for the Ethiopian community.
You've got the Russian model. Build parallel institutions, integrate economically, maintain cultural distinctness. And the Ethiopian model, more of a struggle, slower upward mobility, but second generation closing gaps. What about the Anglos?
Americans, British, Canadians, Australians, South Africans. This is a much smaller group, maybe 150,000 to 200,000 total since 48, but they're interesting because they invert the normal pattern. Most immigrants come from poorer countries to a richer one. Anglo-immigrants typically come from wealthier countries. They're often older, already professionally established, and many come with savings or retirement income. Their Hebrew acquisition rate is, let's be charitable and say, variable.
I've noticed. There are people here 20 years who still order coffee in English.
That works because English is widely spoken in Israel, especially in professional and commercial settings. So the Anglo community can function in a kind of linguistic bubble that would be impossible for a Russian speaker or an Amharic speaker. They also tend to cluster geographically. Jerusalem neighborhoods like Baca and Katamon, Ra'anana, Beit Shemesh, parts of Tel Aviv. The integration model is almost the opposite of the Russian one. Rather than building ethnic institutions, Anglos tend to enter Israeli institutions but often transform them from within. The number of Anglo immigrants in Israeli high tech, in academia, in the legal profession, in journalism, it's disproportionate. They bring native English skills and often Western professional networks, which the Israeli economy values highly.
They don't need to assimilate in the same way because English functions as a kind of parallel elite language.
And there's a class dimension to this that makes people uncomfortable but is real. An American lawyer making aliyah has a very different experience from a Yemenite Jew airlifted in 1949 or an Ethiopian farmer in 1991. The system treats them differently, the economy treats them differently, and society treats them differently.
What about the French? That's a big wave in the last 15 years.
Since about 2010, roughly 50,000 to 60,000 French Jews have made aliyah, and they're a fascinating hybrid case. They come from a Western country with high education levels, similar to the Anglos, but they're not coming with English. They're coming with French, which has far less utility in the Israeli economy. So there's more pressure to learn Hebrew, and many do. But they've also clustered residentially. Netanya has become known as a French immigrant hub, parts of Jerusalem too. They brought French culinary culture with them, which I personally appreciate.
The bakeries alone.
Worth the entire absorption budget. But more seriously, the French wave has been driven partly by economic concerns. France's economy has been sluggish, and partly by security concerns and rising anti-Semitism. So the motivation mix is different from, say, ideological Zionists from America, or refugees from the Soviet Union.
Let's go back to something you said earlier about the early waves, the Mizrahi immigration. Jews from Arab and Muslim-majority countries was the biggest chunk in the early decades. Something like half of Israeli Jews today are of Mizrahi origin, and that's almost entirely a product of post-1948 immigration. How did their integration compare?
This is the foundational story that shapes Israeli society to this day, and it's complicated. Between 1948 and the early 1960s, roughly 600,000 Jews arrived from Arab countries, Iraq, Yemen, Morocco, Egypt, Libya, Syria, and others. In many cases, these were ancient communities that had existed for millennia. Iraq's Jewish community was 2,600 years old. And in most cases, they came not just as immigrants, but as refugees. Their property was confiscated, they were expelled or fled under threat. So from the start, this was not voluntary migration in the way an American making aliyah today experiences it.
The absorption was...
That's putting it mildly. The state was poor, overwhelmed, and frankly, the Ashkenazi establishment, the labor Zionist leadership that dominated the early state, had cultural biases. They saw these Mizrahi immigrants as backward, as needing to be modernized. There was a paternalistic absorption model that wasn't just about teaching Hebrew and job skills, it was about remaking people's identities, often with disregard for their existing cultural and religious traditions. The Ma'abaro, the transit camps, were disproportionately filled with Mizrahi immigrants. Many stayed in those conditions for years. The geographic settlement pattern also mattered. Mizrahi immigrants were often placed in peripheral development towns, far from the center, which created lasting spatial inequality.
The political consequences are still with us. The Likud's rise in the 70s was largely driven by Mizrahi voters who felt the labor establishment had failed them.
Menachem Begin spoke to that sense of grievance and exclusion, and it worked. The ethnic political divide in Israel is less sharp now than it was in the 70s and 80s. Intermarriage between Ashkenazi and Mizrahi Jews is very common now. Something like a quarter of Jewish Israeli marriages are mixed. Origin, but the socioeconomic gaps haven't fully closed. Mizrahi Jews still have lower average incomes and educational attainment than Ashkenazi Jews, though the gaps have narrowed significantly.
If we're mapping integration models, the Mizrahi wave was supposed to be full assimilation into the dominant labor Zionist culture, and the resistance to that created a counter-identity that reshaped Israeli politics.
And I think that's the key insight here. Integration isn't a single destination, it's a negotiation. Every wave of immigrants has negotiated differently with the receiving society, and the outcomes depend on what they brought, what they found, and how the negotiation went.
There's something else that the raw numbers don't capture. The 3.4 million figure includes people who came, stayed a few years, and left. Do we know much about return migration?
It's understudied, but the estimates I've seen suggest that somewhere between 10 and 15% of immigrants eventually leave permanently. It varies enormously by origin. Return rates are highest among immigrants from wealthy Western countries. Americans, Canadians, Western Europeans, and much lower among immigrants from countries they can't safely return to for obvious reasons. The Soviet Aliyah had relatively low return rates despite the fall of the USSR, partly because many had burned their bridges and partly because by the time Russia stabilized economically in the 2000s, they'd already built lives here.
There's the phenomenon of the yo-yo Aliyah, people who go back and forth, never fully committing to either place.
Which is increasingly common in a globalized economy where you can work remotely. I know plenty of people who technically made Aliyah, got citizenship, and then spend half the year in London or New York consulting. The Israeli government doesn't love this. The whole point of Aliyah from the state's perspective is permanent settlement, but it's hard to prevent and probably not worth preventing.
You mentioned the military as an integration vehicle. Let's go deeper on that, because it's one of those things that sounds obvious, but actually works in very specific ways.
The IDF is arguably the most powerful integration mechanism Israel has, and it operates on multiple levels. First, there's the Hebrew immersion. For young immigrants who serve, it's basically an intensive language course combined with social mixing. Second, there's the network effect. The people you serve with become your social and professional network for life. That's true for native Israelis too, but for immigrants it's especially important because they arrive without existing networks. Third, military service is a credential. Israeli employers look at where you served and what you did, and it functions as a signal of capability and social integration.
It's not equally available to everyone. If you make Aliyah at age 28 with two kids, you're not doing 3 years in Golani.
The military integration path works best for immigrants who arrive young, either as children with their parents or as single young adults who can do service. It does very little for mid-career professionals or families. And that's a structural inequality in the absorption system. The state offers a basket of benefits: cash payments, Hebrew classes, tax breaks. But the real integration accelerators are informal and unevenly distributed.
Let's talk about the cash. What does the state actually give new immigrants?
It's called the Sal Klita, the absorption basket. As of the last few years, it's about 25,000 to 30,000 shekels total over the first 6 to 12 months, paid in installments. Plus free Hebrew classes, the open system, plus various tax exemptions on importing household goods, buying a car, purchasing a home. New immigrants get reduced property taxes for a period, and there's mortgage assistance. It's not nothing, but it's also not enough to live on by itself. Most immigrants need savings or family support or immediate employment.
Open. The Hebrew classes. How effective is that actually?
Mixed reviews, let's say. The open system was designed in the 1950s, and the basic model hasn't changed radically. It works reasonably well for motivated learners with prior language learning experience. It works less well for older immigrants, people with lower formal education, and anyone who doesn't thrive in a classroom setting. The state open is free for the first 5 months, but the quality varies enormously depending on the teacher and the mix of students. I've heard immigrants describe it as everything from life-changing to completely useless.
The completely useless crowd tends to be the ones who then take private lessons or learn on the job.
Or don't learn at all and function in English or Russian. Which circles back to our earlier point, the integration path depends enormously on whether you have a linguistic fallback option.
There's one group we haven't talked about that I think is worth mentioning. The Latin American Aliyah. It's smaller, but it's been studied for decades.
Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, Mexico, more recently, Venezuela. The total is probably around 100,000 to 120,000 since 48. And they're interesting because they share some features with the French Aliyah, coming from middle-class backgrounds, often with professional training. But Spanish and Portuguese have even less utility in the Israeli economy than French. So there's real pressure to acquire Hebrew, and most do. The Latin American community has integrated without the kind of parallel institutional structure the Russians built, and without the linguistic enclave the Anglos enjoy. It's a more standard integration path: Hebrew acquisition, economic integration over time, intermarriage with native Israelis. Nothing dramatic, which is maybe why it gets less attention.
The quiet immigrants.
Not every story is a crisis or triumph. Some communities just...
Okay, let's step back and do the thing you're good at. What does the data actually show about integration outcomes across these different groups? Employment? Education? Income? Language? Is there a ranking?
The Israeli Central Bureau of Statistics and various academic studies track this. Employment-wise, immigrants from the former Soviet Union and from Western countries have the highest labor force participation rates, often exceeding the native-born Jewish average. Ethiopian immigrants have the lowest, though the gap narrows in the second generation. Income-wise, it's a similar pattern. Western and Russian-speaking immigrants converge toward the native-born average within about 10 to 15 years. Ethiopian immigrants take longer, and the gap hasn't fully closed even in the second generation, though it's narrowing.
What about the French?
The French data is still emerging because the wave is relatively recent, but early indications suggest they're integrating well economically, high employment rates. Many in professional occupations, though there's been some friction around housing costs since many arrived with capital and contributed to price increases in neighborhoods like Netanya and parts of Jerusalem.
The economic integration story is broadly positive for most groups, with the Ethiopian community as the notable exception, and the Mizrahi community as the historical exception, that's largely been resolved over generations.
That's a fair summary, but I want to complicate the resolved part for Mizrahi Jews. The intergenerational mobility story is real and encouraging. but there are still neighborhoods, schools, and occupations where ethnic stratification persists. It's not the sharp divide it was in the 70s, but it hasn't vanished either.
There's a cultural dimension we haven't touched. Integration isn't just about money and language. It's about whether you feel Israeli, whether you feel the society is yours.
This is harder to measure, but survey data gives us some clues. The Israeli Democracy Index and other surveys consistently find that immigrants from different origins report different levels of belonging. Russian-speaking immigrants, even after decades, often report feeling somewhat outside the Israeli mainstream, not excluded exactly, but not fully inside either. Ethiopian immigrants report the lowest sense of belonging, which correlates with experiences of discrimination. Anglo and French immigrants tend to report higher belonging, partly because they chose to come. It's voluntary, ideological migration, and partly because they're received more warmly by the society.
Received more warmly meaning less discrimination.
Meaning less discrimination, yes. An American accent in Israel is a social asset. An Amharic accent is not. That's uncomfortable, but true.
The Mizrahi experience is different again, because they're not immigrants anymore. They're second, third, fourth generation. Their sense of belonging is complicated by the fact that they are Israeli, indisputably. But they also carry a historical memory of exclusion.
And that memory shapes political behavior, cultural production, religious practice. Mizrahi Jews revolutionized Israeli music. What we think of as Israeli music today is largely Mizrahi-influenced, though it took decades for the establishment to recognize it as legitimate. The same thing happened with food, with religious practice, with television. The integration story isn't just immigrants becoming Israeli, it's Israel changing to accommodate them.
That's the two-way street that people always talk about, but rarely define. What does it actually mean for a host society to be changed by its immigrants?
It means the culture shifts. Israeli food in 1950 was Eastern European, gefilte fish, chicken soup, schnitzel. Today it's hummus, shakshuka, jaknun, malawak, spicy fish, all brought by Mizrahi immigrants and initially looked down upon. Israeli music in 1950 was Russian and Eastern European folk traditions. Today it's a fusion that draws heavily on Arabic musical scales and Yemenite vocal traditions. The Hebrew language itself has absorbed vocabulary and speech patterns from the different immigrant waves. The political culture has been reshaped. The old secular Ashkenazi labor establishment is gone, replaced by a much more ethnically diverse political landscape where religious and traditional voters have enormous influence.
The immigrants didn't just join Israel. They remade it.
That's the long arc, and we're still in it. The Russian wave of the 90s changed Israeli politics, Israeli tech, Israeli culture. The French wave is changing neighborhoods and consumer culture. The Ethiopian community is slowly changing Israeli conversations about race and identity, though there's a long way to go. Every wave leaves its mark.
Let's talk about the ideological dimension, because I think it separates Israel from most other immigration countries. Aliyah isn't just immigration. It's framed as return. The law of return gives any Jew in the world the right to citizenship. That's a fundamentally different premise from, say, Canada's point system.
And it creates tensions that are specific to Israel. One is the tension between Aliyah as ideology and Aliyah as pragmatic migration. The state frames it as ideology. You're coming home. You're fulfilling the Zionist dream. But for many immigrants, especially from the former Soviet Union and more recently from France, the motives are mixed. Economic opportunity, personal safety, quality of life. The state doesn't always know how to handle people who make Aliyah for reasons that aren't ideological. The absorption system was built on an assumption of ideological commitment that doesn't always match reality.
Then there's the tension around who counts. The law of return covers anyone with at least one Jewish grandparent, which means a significant portion of immigrants from the former Soviet Union are not halakhically Jewish. They're Israeli citizens. They serve in the army. But they can't get married in Israel because the rabbinate doesn't recognize them as Jewish. That's a fundamental integration barrier.
It's estimated that roughly 300,000 Israelis from the former Soviet Union fall into this category, citizens under the law of return but not recognized as Jewish by the rabbinate. They're integrated in every civic sense, but excluded from the religious establishment. It's created a whole parallel system of civil marriage abroad. People fly to Cyprus or Prague to get married, then register the marriage in Israel. The state tolerates this, but won't solve it because the religious secular status quo is too politically sensitive.
Integration can be complete in some dimensions and blocked in others.
That's true for different groups in different ways. For the Russian-speaking community, the integration barrier is religious recognition. For the Ethiopian community, it's socioeconomic mobility and social acceptance. For Anglos, there's barely a barrier at all, except maybe learning Hebrew well enough to read a government form. The barriers are unevenly distributed, which means the integration experience is fundamentally different depending on where you come from.
I want to go back to something you said about the military. You called it an integration mechanism, but it's also an exclusion mechanism for anyone who doesn't serve. Arab citizens of Israel don't serve for the most part. Haredi Jews have historically been exempt. So, the military as integrator model works for the people who are already inside the tent.
And for immigrants, the tent includes them. Most Jewish immigrants serve or their children serve. But it's worth noting that the integration power of the military is contingent on a broader social consensus about who serves and who doesn't. If that consensus shifts, and there are signs it might be shifting around Haredi service, the integration function of the military could change too.
Let's pull on that thread. The Haredi community isn't an immigrant community in the usual sense. They've been here since before the state, but they function in some ways as a parallel society with its own institutions, its own education system, its own media. Are there lessons from the immigrant integration experience that apply to Haredi integration?
That's a provocative parallel, and I think there's something to it. The Haredi community has achieved what the Russian-speaking community achieved: parallel institutions, cultural autonomy, economic integration on its own terms, but at a much larger scale and with much higher stakes, because the Haredi population is growing very fast. The difference is that the Russian-speaking community's parallel institutions were a transitional phase. The second generation integrated more fully. The Haredi parallel institutions are designed to be permanent. So it's not really the same model.
Let's come back to the numbers. 3.4 million. I want to put that in some kind of comparative context. How does Israel's immigration to population ratio compare to other countries?
It's extraordinary. The foreign-born share of Israel's Jewish population is somewhere around 35-40%, depending on how you count. Compare that to the United States, where the foreign-born share is about 14%. Australia is around 30%, which is high, but Australia is a classic immigrant society. Canada is about 23%. Israel is in a league of its own for a developed country. It's absorbed a share of immigrants relative to its population that's unprecedented in modern history, and it did it while fighting multiple wars and building an economy from scratch.
Yet the narrative in Israel is often one of absorption failure. The ma'abaro, the discrimination, the gaps that persist. Which story is true?
The absorption was a success in the sense that 3.4 million people came and the country didn't collapse. It thrived. It became a technological and military power. The immigrants built the country. That's a success. But it was also a failure in the sense that the costs were borne unequally, that whole communities were marginalized, that the wounds of the ma'abara are still felt generations later. You can hold both truths at once.
That's the thing about Israeli history. Every success story has a counter story, and they're both real.
The counter story is part of the integration now. The Mizrahi narrative of discrimination and resilience has become part of Israeli identity. It's in the music, the literature, the politics. The Ethiopian protests against police violence in 2015 and 2019 weren't just about policing. They were about the failure of integration and the demand to be fully seen. These aren't side stories, they're the main story.
Let's talk about the future. The major reservoirs of world Jewry that haven't made Aliyah are the United States, about 6 million Jews, and France, maybe 450,000. The American community is wealthy, secure, and ideologically divided on Israel. The French community is nervous, but not yet fleeing en masse. Are we likely to see another million-person wave?
I don't think so. Not from those communities. American Jews are not coming in large numbers. The annual American Aliyah has been around 3,000 to 4,000 for years, and there's no sign of a surge. France had a spike in the mid-2000s, but the numbers have leveled off. The big demographic reservoirs that produced the mass waves, the Soviet Union, the Arab world, Ethiopia, have largely been emptied of their Jewish populations. The remaining Jewish diaspora is concentrated in countries where Jews are secure and prosperous. Barring a major crisis, the era of mass aliyah is probably over.
The 3.4 million number will keep growing, but slowly.
Maybe another 100,000 over the next decade from various places. The bigger story going forward isn't immigration, but internal demographics. The Haredi and Arab population growth, the secular Jewish fertility rate, the balance between different groups within the country. Immigration shaped Israel's first 75 years. The next 75 will be shaped more by who's already here.
That's a sobering thought to end on, but I think we've earned it. Let's do Hilbert's fun fact and wrap.
Now Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, a British expedition to Nepal documented the lichen species that absorbs arsenic from the surrounding rock and concentrates it in its outer layer. A single specimen preserved in the Royal Botanic Gardens still contains detectable levels of the original toxin, making it both a biological record and a 240-year-old poison sample.
Right. The integration story is really a reminder that nations aren't static containers that immigrants pour into. They're conversations. And the conversation keeps going. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Frumingtop. If you enjoyed this, rate us wherever you get your podcasts. We're at myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.